Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
So let's say this is the resurrection of Jesus. I look at this and say, right, the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus is very, very, very small, very low value indeed. So if I was to believe the claim that Jesus resurrected, I would need to fill up my pint glass with a lot more stuff.
The fact that miracles do in fact stand out against this regular natural order, the way nature normally behaves, cannot be taken as evidence against miracles when used as signs, because that very hypothesis predicts with very high probability that that's exactly what you'll find.
We are going to be today actually arguing about why are our background knowledges, why are our worldviews different?
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome back to the show. A proper old debate for you today. Atheist blogger Jonathan Pierce versus Christian apologist Jonathan McClatchy. Unbelievable is the place for conversations that matter. We've got some real corkers lining up for the start of the year. And if you enjoy this show, you might enjoy our other podcast from Premier Unbelievable, currently airing some long-form talks from Tom Wright on the Ask NT Wright Anything podcast on Jesus for Everyone and Jesus the Revolutionary. And a new season of the C.S. Lewis podcast with Alistair McGrath is just starting up at the moment, talking about Lewis and the meaning crisis. I'm currently covering for Ruth Jackson as host of that at the moment. And we've exciting news of more podcasts, more resources, and a new mini website coming soon. That'll be ahead of the launch of a brand new fully fledged website for Premier Unbelievable at our Unbelievable conference in May. Planning to bring you full news of that soon as well. But for now, put Saturday, the 14th of May, in your diary. We'll be making sure that this is fully accessible from anywhere in the world online, but we will be back in person as well in London. Your feedback is coming up later on in the show. You can get more from the show via our newsletter and the ways to support us at our webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Right now, let's get into today's show. Well, on today's show, we're asking, do extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence? It's a famous maxim popularized by Carl Sagan, but arguably originating with David Hume. And he argued that the likelihood of miraculous events was so intrinsically improbable that the type of evidence required to justify belief in them would be overwhelmingly larger than for other kinds of events. We'll be asking if Hume was right in the company of two Jonathans today. Jonathan Pierce is an atheist blogger and writer whose recent books include Why I Am Atheist and Not a Theist. And the subtitle is How to Do Knowledge, Meaning and Morality in a Godless World. And also The Resurrection, A Critical Examination of the Easter Story, both of which will be relevant to today's conversation. Jonathan McClatchy is a Christian apologist with a background in biology. He's recently established a new resource called talkaboutdoubts.com, which aims to help Christians who are experiencing doubts or deconstruction to talk about it one-to-one with another Christian thinker. So we're asking today, do extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence? Or is that a faulty way of assessing the way evidence works? This one, I think, is inevitably going to be a bit philosophical, but we'll try to keep it user-friendly, explaining any complex terms as we go along. So welcome along, Jonathan Pierce and Jonathan McClatchy. And because you're both very confusingly called Jonathan today, I'm going to use acronyms, JM for Jonathan McClatchy, JP for Jonathan Pierce. So JP, first of all, welcome along. Welcome back. It's been just over a year, I think, since you were last with us doing a debate on The Nativity with Lydia McGrew, I think, was the last time you appeared. Tell us what you've been up to in the last year. I know you seem to be prodigious in terms of the book writing. You've got another one, I think, due to appear shortly. But tell us what you've been working on recently.
Well, thank you for inviting me on. Hopefully it will be an absolute pleasure. Last time I was on, I was debating The Nativity, A Critical Examination with Lydia McGrew. And I'm writing a trilogy of books whereby I've since brought out The Resurrection, A Critical Examination of the Easter Story, that we'll be debating in applying the maxim today, which I think, I'm really proud of that book. It's had loads of great endorsements. And I also brought out a book called Why I Am Atheist and Not a Theist. A nice bit of wordplay there, which is about building up my worldview from the bottom up. And again, that's something that's pretty relevant for today, which is, what are we bringing to the table? How are we constructing our worldview? And are we starting from the bottom, stripping everything back and then starting from the bottom and working upwards to then arrive at a conclusion? Or are we starting at a conclusion and trying to backfill? So that's what I'd be doing. I'm also got another book coming out, 30 Arguments Against God, The Existence of God. And also I'm working on the third part of the trilogy, which is The Exodus, A Critical Examination of the Moses Story, which is also possibly relevant because I wouldn't mind mentioning some of the Old Testament miracles today or the Hebrew Bible miracles. So that's what I've been doing. Thank you. Do you want to speak to JM
well,
now?
Well, I was going to say all of those sound really interesting. And who knows, maybe we could get you back on for the Exodus one because I've been wanting to redo the Exodus story.
I'm co-writing that with an archaeologist, so actually that should be good.
Oh well, that sounds fascinating. Well, thanks for coming back, Jonathan P. JP, for today's purpose of today's show. JM, Jonathan McClatchy, also a welcome back to you. It's been probably a little longer since we had you on the show. So tell us what life is like for you at the moment. I know you've been very busy. You've got married, I think, probably since the last time we had you on, and living in the US at the moment. So tell us what life is looking like for you.
Right. So thanks so much, Justin, for having me on again. It's a pleasure to be here. I got married in 2019. I completed my PhD at Newcastle University in January of 2020. I currently work as an assistant professor of biology at a local Christian college in Boston called Sattler College, which is an Anabaptist school. I teach principles of biology to freshman students, genetics and genomics. I teach bioethics. I teach microbiology. So that's what I've been up to over the last 2.5 years. We actually just got recently accredited, and we're now in our fourth year of operation as a school. So.
Wonderful. Tell me about talkaboutdoubts.com. What's that all about?
Yeah, so talkaboutdoubts.com is a ministry that is geared towards mentoring and counseling Christians, or sometimes ex-Christians, who are struggling with doubts in regards to the veracity of the Christian faith. So this is something I've done on my personal website since 2016, and I've been mentoring Christians who are walking through a deconstruction process. I've typically had on average one or two requests a week through my personal website. And more recently, I thought that it would be a good idea to bring in other scholars and experts in different fields and push the advertising for this sort of project more and get more uptake, which I wouldn't be able to handle all by myself. But we have a team so far of more than 30 scholars and experts in various fields. We have some big names associated with our team. We have Dr. Timothy McGrew, who's been on Unbelievable before a couple of times. We've got Dr. Stephen Meyer of the Discovery Institute, who's involved, and Dr. Luke Barnes, who's also been on this show before. So basically, people submit a form through the website, and that comes to us, and we review the requests for a conversation, and then we send them out to the individual that would be most suitable for answering that particular question. And different scholars are down for different frequencies, or some are taking calls up to once a week, some up to once a month, and so forth. And so that helps us to determine who best to send that to, and then that scholar will get in touch with that inquirer and set up a one-on-one Zoom call to discuss their doubts with them in confidence and help them to develop, answer their questions and doubts, educate them about the evidence for Christianity, and help them to develop a protocol for working through their doubts and concerns in an intellectually responsible and methodical way.
Hmm. And what's the advantage of this sort of much more, if you like, one-to-one way of doing things than just giving people, you know, lots of articles on our website that might hopefully address their concerns or questions.
Yeah, I think it's certainly more personable and allows us to develop a relationship with these people. Some people I've mentored over a period of several months or even years. One person actually has reconverted to Christianity through this ministry project. I have other people who've said that it's changed their life in the sense that they would have walked away had they not had this intervention. And and having a one-on-one call via Zoom with them allows them to ask their questions in a live way instead of reading an article and then having to write back with their questions and wait some days for a response. They get a response right there and then, and they're actually talking to someone who's a bona fide expert in that particular field.
Well, it's quite a remarkable project you've taken on, talkaboutdoubts.com. Just be interested in JM, in JP even, in your response to that. What do you make of this particular project?
Actually, I did want to say something to that, which is it sounds very much like William Lane Craig's Reasonable Faith website, but it's more democratic. So it's instead of saying you have some kind of authoritarian figure of William Lane Craig just delivering his views on everything, or his team, because he has a team, but actually I quite like the idea that no, this question will be best answered by this particular person. So it's sending it to the right person for the job. So, you know, although I'll disagree almost entirely with everything that your experts will say, no doubt, it's a worthy cause if that's...
Yeah, I was going to say, JM, that in a sense, could you imagine something like this for the atheist? I mean, is this primarily just for Christians, really, who are going through doubts, or would you anticipate an interested inquirer, an agnostic or atheist who's got questions, also being able to access this particular service?
Yeah, we have atheists that get in touch with us and have sincere questions about the Christian faith, want to learn about the evidence for it. And so, yeah, I very much welcome sincere atheists. We're not an informal debate club. So if you're just wanting a one-on-one debate, then sorry, you might want to try elsewhere. Perhaps that's Justin if he'll have you on to do a debate. But yeah, we're more interested in having one-on-one informal conversations with people that are sincerely interested in exploring the question of whether or not Christianity is true.
Well, I'll leave links to that from today's show, talkaboutdoubts.com, also to your own website, Jonathan McClatchy, and yours as well, Jonathan Pierce, a Tipling philosopher over at Pathos, where you can find out all about the books.
Well, so actually, here's an interesting thing to say about that. So last time I was on debating with David French about cancel culture, and the non-religious channel at Pathos has pretty much just been cancelled. So because we didn't align, we were too anti-religious, obviously, and too political. So literally it's been cancelled. So there's a brand new platform just starting up, which is big news, actually, because you might be very interested in this, Justin, because it's a media platform predominantly based in America called Only Sky that will be aiming to represent the non-religious across the world, but predominantly in America to begin with. And I have been asked to come and join that as a columnist there. So watch this space, because it's going to go live in the next few weeks. And it is a news and media organization particularly tailored for the non-religious.
Well, I look forward to hearing more about that, and perhaps we can have some representatives from this new network in due course. Is that a reference to the John Lennon song "Above Us Only Sky"?
So yeah, it's the idea that, you know, when you look up, there's only sky. You know, it's exactly. So okay. Yeah, there's good references.
There you go. All right. Well, look, great to get some background on both of what you've been up to in the last year or two. And as I say, links will be with today's show. But let's get into the topic that we're here to discuss, which is: do extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence? Jonathan Pierce, why don't you begin by outlining your case here? Again, it'll have to be a very much a nutshell approach. You know,
this is a five-hour debate.
Specifically, exactly. Essentially, this is a case against miracles. And maybe you could sort of outline how you've presented this specifically. You've got quite a fun analogy of the kinds of evidence that would be required to, you know, for a fairly normal claim like I own a dog, compared to some rather more extravagant claim. So go ahead with the way that you.
So this might quite annoy both of you, but I'm not really interested in talking about Hume today, and in fact talking about the maxim as a whole, as far as a rational argument, because I think the maxim is a subjective epistemological statement or maxim. So epistemology is a study of knowledge and truth. So when we say extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, what we're really saying is claims that are out of the ordinary for me require evidence that is out of the ordinary for me to believe those claims. In the same way that for JM, a claim that is out of the ordinary for him, and for you, Justin, will require evidence that is out of the ordinary for you to believe the claim. So this is actually universal, but it is subjective. And so what this then means is that how come that I have the same access to the same evidence as JM has, and I have exactly the same access to exactly the same rational arguments as JM does, that we end up with different conclusions? And that's because of psychology, right? So really, we are going to be today actually arguing about why are our background knowledges, why are our worldviews different? And I'll leave it just with this analogy. So the way I like to simplify this is, I here's a pint, and for those who are listening and not seeing, I'm holding a pint glass which has a tiny amount of orange cordial at the bottom. That orange cordial represents evidence. And for me, this is a tiny amount of evidence in a whole pint, where if I have a full pint, I have a justified belief, right? So let's say this is the resurrection of Jesus. I look at this and say, right, the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus is very, very, very small, very low value indeed. So if I was to believe the claim that Jesus resurrected, I would need to fill up my pint glass with a lot more stuff. And that would require me to fill it up with faith, motivated reasoning, biases, stuff like, you know, heaven and hell, really driving me to want to believe this is true. And the other thing I can do is artificially expand my evaluation of the evidence so that this tiny sliver of orange cordial takes up three quarters of the glass. And my point would be that JM would look at the Gospels. We have the same access to the same evidence and same arguments, but I look at the Gospels and that's how I value it. He looks at the Gospels and he will evaluate the evidence as being three quarters of the glass. So the question is, really today, what we need to be talking about is, what are we bringing to the table that means that our evaluations of both the claim, like what is an ordinary claim for me is not an ordinary claim for JM. So I might say naturalistic abiogenesis, so the life starting naturalistically, is a normal claim for me. So I won't need as much evidence as he will need. He will see naturalistic abiogenesis as an out of the ordinary claim, and he will need evidence that is far beyond what I would require. And same for the resurrection. So what do we bring into the table, and how can we meet in such a way that we start understanding each other and start having maybe a benchmark for how we arrive at our worldviews and our background knowledge. Mm.
Okay. Well, thank you for the introduction. And Jonathan M., in a moment, it'd be great to hear your response to this analogy of the pint glass with only a small amount of evidence at the bottom and what we fill the rest of it with to get our hold of our belief. But just let's start with the maxim that we're talking about here, and briefly, do extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence? What is your overall response to that way of looking at claims around Christianity, around miracles and that kind of thing?
So it's certainly true that the amount of evidence that will be deemed sufficient to justify belief in a propositional claim will inversely correlate with the prior probability. So as the prior probability declines, the amount of evidence that you need to provide sufficient justification for a belief will increase. So what do we mean by prior probability? So that's a probability theory term. It's a term used in Bayesian statistics. Prior probability basically denotes the probability of a proposition being true before you've looked at the new data, just based on the background information alone. The prior probability just takes into account what you know in the background before you've looked at the new evidence that you are considering. Now, what do we mean by the concept of evidence? I think it's very important to define what we actually mean by evidence, what counts as evidence. And as a Bayesian, I would define evidence as a likelihood ratio, which measures the strength of a particular piece of evidence. And I know Jonathan would agree with this, or at least that's my impression from reading his work, that the evidence can be expressed as the probability of that evidence existing, given the hypothesis is true, versus the probability of that evidence existing, given the hypothesis is false. So we talk in Bayesian probability theory in terms of a Bayes factor. So a Bayes factor of 3, for example, means that that evidence is 3 times more likely to exist given your hypothesis is true than given its falsity. Now, to say that something is evidence for a particular hypothesis does not commit you to saying that that hypothesis is true. You can say that there's evidence for a hypothesis that you believe is false. And what is incumbent upon us is to adjudicate where does the balance of evidence lie. Are there more numerous and more substantive objections to believing a proposition, or more substantive and more numerous objections to not believing a proposition? The way that I would tend to make a case for things like the resurrection and other aspects of the Christian faith would be as a cumulative argument, where no one of the individual pieces of evidence is individually sufficient to establish and justify the conclusion, but taken cumulatively, because the evidence is multiplied together. If you have 2 pieces of evidence, each with a Bayes factor of 10, for example, that's a cumulative Bayes factor of 100, right? 10 times 10. And so the evidences begin to multiply and accumulate very, very rapidly.
What do you make of this particular analogy Jonathan Pierce has of the pint glass? And essentially, his view is that there's, you know, you're all looking at the same evidence for something like the resurrection. And in his view, it's a very small amount of evidence at the bottom of the glass, and that all kinds of other factors, psychological factors, you know, your commitment to Christianity, whatever it might be, sort of effectively fill up the rest of the glass to make it sort of possible for you to
expand the evidence itself. Yeah, or both.
Or indeed expand the evidence.
Right, for sure. I think Jonathan and I have different priors for something like the resurrection. We can discuss, I think, a bit later how we assess the priors, because I think that we assess the priors in different ways. But I think that we would agree in principle that the amount of evidence you'll need will be inversely correlated with the prior. So if you have a very small prior, you're going to need more evidence to justify a conclusion. And I don't see beliefs as binary, right? Either you believe it or you don't, but more as a confidence level, right? We have different confidence levels, and you might justify confidence in a belief at, say, 90% versus 95% and so forth. And that can be quantified or assessed, determined by a Bayesian calculus.
Can I give an example of that?
Yes, please. I was going to ask for an example, just to make it clear what this sort of idea of the prior and the evidence.
So the claim I've got a table, right? If I said to you I've got a table, I would expect that's a really ordinary claim, and it's an ordinary claim for all of us. So actually, I've chosen something that we can all agree on. So our background knowledge is that most people own tables. He's claimed he's got a table. I will believe that, which has a very high prior probability of being true, which means that most people have tables. Therefore, someone claiming they've got a table is likely to be true, irrespective of the evidence he presents. And the evidence I presented to you is simply verbal testimony. I've just said I've got a table, and I can guarantee you'd be prepared to believe me. And most people on earth will be prepared to believe me, okay? Because it's not an out of the ordinary claim for anyone. But if I said to you, I flew to the moon last night on a unicorn, right? You would, and I've chosen that, some people say, why do you choose these ridiculous examples? The reason I do is because no one's got vested interest in that at all. So this is something we can all agree on. This is outside of our ordinary claims, right? Outside of our background knowledge of how the world works. You shouldn't be able to fly to the moon on the back of a unicorn. So therefore, that's an insanely improbable claim. Like, before we look at the evidence, it's breaking the laws of nature. Unicorns don't exist. Yada, yada, yada. So before we look at the evidence, it's got a really vanishingly low probability chance of being true. So in order to overcome, this is what JM was saying, in order to overcome that very low prior probability, you have to have really high posteriors. You have to have really high evidential really high levels and qualities of evidence to overcome the low prior. And so I would be required by you guys to present a heck of a lot of evidence just so that you would be justified in believing my claim that I flew to the moon and back.
Dialing it back ever so slightly, say you had said, you know, on the one hand, I own a table, neither of us need anything more than your verbal, you know, evidence for that. Say that you had said, I flew to the moon yesterday. Now, would it make any difference if you were Elon Musk, if that was some of the background knowledge and that you owned a massive space program? Would that kind of affect the, if you like, how much evidence I need from you on
Because
that
that's
basis?
Part of our background knowledge about how the world is, right? We know, so if I was Elon Musk and made that claim, we know that Elon Musk owns X, Y, and Z, and it's not breaking the natural laws. So this is actually, if it's flying in a space shuttle, right, then it's not breaking the natural laws, and this is something that could happen. So what's the probability of Elon Musk claiming that and that being true? And we would be assessing the probabilities based on that.
Okay, I just want to get a sense of how these sort of prior probabilities and so on, background information, makes a difference to what kind of level of evidence we're kind of, you know, expecting someone to bring.
The Bayesian probability will depend. So when JM talked about the numbers, he just said rather arbitrarily, you know, rightfully so, he said, like, you know, this number represents this or whatever. That will depend on your background knowledge. And this is why I think that's the most important thing to talk about, is how do we arrive at our background knowledge? Because that will determine your Bayesian probability analyses.
Okay, so some responses to all of this, Jonathan M.
Yeah, I agree with that in principle. And I think the crux of the debate then is how do you assess the priors, which I think will be the point of contention between us. So my impression from reading your book, Jonathan, is that a very important factor for you in assessing the priors is the frequency by which an event occurs, or to what extent it is precedented in our experience. Would that be an accurate summary of your view?
That's certainly part of it. Yeah. It's not only that, it's also the background knowledge. So it's also about, do I believe that miracles are well, not a priori. So this is a frequency. It's like, okay, I can conceptually agree that miracles might be able to take place, but I've never seen them take place. And that's the frequency thing that you're referring to.
Okay. So what's the relevance of that for you, Jonathan McClatchy, the frequency issue that JP says?
Yeah, so I don't consider a frequentist approach to be a very helpful tool in assessing the prior probability of a miracle claim when the miracle claim is understood to function as an authenticating sign, as it is in both the Old and New Testament. So in both the Old and New Testament, the purpose for which miracles are wrought is to authenticate a messenger. So you see this, for example, in the Old Testament, in Deuteronomy 18, for example, Moses tells the people that you can evaluate and assess, adjudicate whether someone really speaks from God by virtue of to what extent he is consistently accurate in forecasting the future. And we see this is miracles used in this way with Moses, for example, as well as an authenticating sign before Pharaoh. In the New Testament, you see Jesus, for example, in Matthew 11, John the Baptist sends disciples to Jesus asking, are you the one we're expecting, or should we be looking for another? And Jesus says to John the Baptist's disciples, go back to John, tell him what you see and hear. The blind receive their sight, the deaf hear, the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, and so forth. In other words, go back and tell him about the authenticating signs. John even uses that expression, signs, and says that these signs are written about so that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ and therefore have life in his name. And so if miracles are to function as signs, then they have to stand out against a regular natural order. They have to deviate from the normal course of nature. And so the hypothesis that God has used miracles as authenticating signs predicts very strongly that they will stand out against the normal course of nature, go against the way that nature behaves if left to itself. And so the fact that miracles do in fact stand out against this regular natural order, the way nature normally behaves, cannot be taken as evidence against miracles when used as signs, because that very hypothesis predicts with very high probability that that's exactly what you'll find.
Really interesting point, and I'm going to come back to you, JP, in just a moment. We're going to go to a break, but I suppose the point is there, Jonathan McClatchy, that by definition, a miracle is a rare event, because if it wasn't, then it wouldn't be, you know, a momentous thing, an interesting thing, something, as you say, out of the ordinary. We'll see what Jonathan Pierce has to say in response to that in a moment's time. We're asking today, do extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence? We'll be back with my guests, Jonathan McClatchy and Jonathan Pierce, in just a moment.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the show. Bit of a philosophical debate today, but one which hinges on things like miracles, claims of extraordinary events in the Old and New Testament, particularly, of course, the resurrection. That's one I'm sure we'll talk about in the course of today's show. Do extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence? My guests are Jonathan Pierce and Jonathan McClatchy. Talkaboutdoubts.com is the new website from Jonathan McClatchy. And he's here to talk about the doubts that many people have, obviously, around things like the resurrection, extraordinary claims of miracles and so on, with Jonathan Pierce, who's a writer. And again, some of his books available from the links with today's show. So in that last segment, Jonathan Pierce, Jonathan McClatchy saying, to say that, you know, to say that the reason that, you know, miracles are unlikely is because of their how infrequently they occur or supposedly occur, the fact that you haven't seen one yourself and so on. Well, that is just a factor of miracles. They are unusual because by nature they're there to do something unusual, and therefore that can't be used as evidence against their existence. What's your view on that?
I think in what he was saying, he presupposes, A, the truth of the claim that God exists, and B, he presupposes the truth of these other miracles and signs, in particular the Old Testament, which I think is hugely problematic. And in fact, you speak to any Hebrew Bible scholar now, I mean, go and speak to someone like Joel Baden and say, do you think prophecies were predictive? And he'll say, no, they were written ex eventu, which means prophecies, no serious Hebrew scholar, evangelical Christians are a different thing, but no serious Hebrew scholar thinks that there was any kind of prophetic writing going on in the Old Testament. And it was written after the fact to supposedly prophesy an event. But I also would, you know, I'd be questioning basically the history of the Hebrew Bible entirely. So when he talks about Moses, I don't think Moses existed as a person. So I think it's really problematic. I mean, there's no historical evidence that Moses existed. You look at the Elephantine papyri, which are from the 400s BCE, and these are these hundreds of early Jewish documents, and they have no reference to the Torah, no reference to any names in the Torah. We've got no reference to any of the stories, Exodus, anything. It looks like the Hebrew Bible was written pretty darned late, and none of it is particularly historically defensible or archaeologically so. So anyway, the point is that I think, and Jonathan's done this in a couple of essays he's written on this topic, and he says the truth of the resurrection is given a higher probability given the truth of the virgin birth. And that's given a higher probability given or the resurrection given the truth of Isaiah 53:10 and given the truth of all these Old Testament things. And I'd say, hang on, you're saying something that I think has got a very low probability is more likely to be true because of something else that's got even lower probability. And something else that's got even lower probability. And it's the turtles all the way down. And I think it's the whole framework. It's like the Gospels as a whole or the Bible as a whole that needs to be stripped away, start again. What do we know historically?
Well, let's put that back to you then, JM. So this is where we're talking about sort of whether something that is improbable, like someone coming back to life, whether it's made more probable by some of the background knowledge. And just for the sake of, you know, those who are watching and listening, just sketch out some of the reasons why, for instance, in the case of the resurrection of Jesus, you think that some of the background information does make it more likely that that really did happen. And then we'll come to some of Jonathan Pierce's objections to that very background knowledge that you make claim to.
Sure. Just a brief word about what Jonathan said just there. My argument that I just made doesn't presuppose any of that. All I'm saying is that in principle, a miracle is an event which stands out from the normal course of nature, and therefore the fact that a miracle deviates from the normal course of nature can't be used as evidence against a miracle when defined as special divine action as an authenticating sign. And so what Jonathan's wanting to do is he's wanting to get into the particulars of whether we have evidence for the historicity of Moses and the Exodus and Old Testament miracles and prophecies and so forth. And that's all fair and well. One can discuss that. It doesn't have any bearing on, in principle, the argument that I just outlined. Now, let me give an analogy which I think helps to clarify this debate. And this is an analogy that I draw from my colleague and friend, Dr. Timothy McGrew, who's an epistemologist and philosopher at Western Michigan University. And that is, he points out that there's a interpretation of nuclear physics which says that spontaneous proton decay happens, and it's such a rare event that it's never been observed. It's an unprecedented event, and yet there's a theoretical underpinning for this interpretation that spontaneous nuclear decay proton decay happens. And so And there's actually a whole wiki page on the theoretical underpinnings of that. And scientists, of course, have set up these very sensitive detectors in underground tanks to try to detect this spontaneous proton decay. It's not that this is just a random guess, even though there's no precedent for this. There's no example of this happening in our observation. But there is a theoretical underpinning. And so frequency there isn't the most helpful metric for assessing the prior probability. You also want to look for whether there's a theoretical underpinning for this hypothesis. And likewise, with the case for Christianity, the case for the resurrection in particular, I think that you can make a similar case from a theoretical underpinning, a background information that stands independently of the extent to which there is precedence in our experience of the miraculous. One other point I'll make there is that the idea that miracles go against uniform human experience, which was the idea put forward by David Hume, is controversial. In fact, Craig Keener has a two-volume set on the subject of miracles, where he outlines case after case after case of documented miracle claims in the modern world, many of which are within his own sphere of acquaintances and friends, contacts. He talks about people who were blind from birth being healed when they were prayed over. He talks about people who had cancer or MS, which spontaneously disappeared after prayer. He talks about people being able to speak in tongues in foreign lands and be understood in people's native languages, even though they did not hitherto speak that language. And there's so many cases and so many diverse cases, often with multiple independent attestation, and often with medical documentation, that suggests to me that although not everyone that claims to have experienced a miracle in fact has, there's enough that are credible to suggest to me cumulatively that the miracles are within the realm of human experience. And one can argue against that and say, well, we can dismiss all of these miracle claims because they stand out against, they go against uniform human experience, but that's the very point of issue. And so it requires that you engage in circular reasoning.
I was just going to ask, just before Jonathan Pierce comes back on this, coming back to the maxim that we started the show with, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Is it your view then that someone who says, look, Jonathan, if you want me to believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I would not just need sort of, some ancient, writings in the New Testament that bear witness to it. I would need, some kind of video testimony of it. I would need something, Jesus Christ appearing before me and telling me it really happened, or something like really extraordinary, a kind of super high level of. And are you saying that actually you don't need all of that extraordinary evidence, because with enough of these cumulative aspects of background knowledge, whether it be that this was prophesied, that this, there were various reasons why this made sense in its context and everything else, that kind of, if you like, gives you enough that if you like, more normal standards of evidence, such as written testimony and that kind of thing, is enough to kind of give you enough, over 50% or whatever it might be probability that this really did happen. Just explain why this kind of means you don't need that extraordinary kind of evidence.
Sure. So I can give just a couple examples of independent lines of evidence that bear on Jesus' messianic and divine identity. One would be, I think there's merit to C.S. Lewis's trilemma argument that he fleshes out and develops in Mere Christianity, which says that Jesus historically claimed divine status. I think there's a strong historical case for that. That being the case, there's three possible candidate explanations for that contention, for that testimonial claim. One is that Jesus lied about it. He was setting out to deceive others. One is that he's honestly mistaken, he's sincerely wrong, or one is that he really is who he claimed to be, the creator of the universe and God incarnate. And C.S. Lewis points out that that the two competing contenders, namely that he lied and that he was honestly mistaken, are implausible. Jesus he gets himself crucified, he's executed in excruciating circumstances for his messianic and divine self claims, and that provides some evidence that he was sincere in that belief. And then there's also evidence that suggests that he was that he wasn't honestly mistaken, because it's very difficult to be honestly mistaken about the fact that you are God incarnate, the creator of the universe, unless you're completely insane. Jonathan, I think you want to respond.
Goodness, I want to respond at length to so much of what you said. Just on that last bit, I think there's another option, which is legendary embellishment. I think there's the Johannine problem, the synoptic problem. So you've got Matthew, Mark and Luke think he's the Messiah. John is the only one that thinks he's actually God. And even if you do think he's the Messiah, which the Messianic age is supposed to bring about a peace to Jerusalem, peace to all of Israel, what happened after Jesus died, Jerusalem was raised and Israel been in conflict ever since. So he's the most failed Messiah you can think of. But I think the Synoptic Gospels think he was a Messiah and not God, and think John thought after 80 years of theologizing, thought he was God. But going back to Craig Keener's miracles, huge problems with that. I mean, read Ed Babinski's chapter in the Case Against Miracles, edited by John Loftus, but just look at the claims in Craig Keener. I mean, they are so poorly attested. I remember when that book came out, I took the first claim with a biologist contributor to my then blog, and we looked at one about tubular ligation and found out that and we explained it naturalistically almost straight away. It took us like 2 hours to debunk it. But even the claims of Leo Bauer that he has in there, where there's he resurrects a baby, right? And you're like, okay, who's a baby? What's the email address? What's the telephone number? What's the address of these people? Who are these people? No idea. No knowledge of them. Okay, so this is just an assertion of some guy in Nigeria, and I'm not disrespecting Nigeria, but you just got some random guy, Leo Bauer. Okay, but what other ways of verifying these claims do we have? None. Okay, so like, if you're happy to believe that, that's great, but I would need way more evidence than Craig Keener remotely even provides. So I think he's got hugely problematic methodology in his book, and I don't think his book does what Christians think it does. When you've talked in your articles about multiple sclerosis, I've got primary progressive multiple sclerosis, right? So I can tell you a little bit about multiple sclerosis. And you talk about two supposed miracles to do with MS sufferers, which are completely explicable by the fact that it's 85% of MS sufferers have relapsing remitting MS, which the very nature of the disease is that it relapses and then goes into remission. And so, we can talk about MS. I'd love to talk about that. But what you have to do with modern miracles is you have to connect causality of remission, and it's never growing back amputated arms. It's always something that can naturally happen, right? And you have to say, this person was prayed for, and I'm drawing a correlation, a causation from praying to the remission, right? But what about all the times that people have got better without being prayed for? What about all the failed prayers for people? And what about alternative explanations for all these hypotheses?
So quite a lot of responding there as well. I mean, and we've also got the issue of, whether the claims of prophecy in the Old Testament and, the existence of Old Testament characters like Moses are actually, lend credence to your claim of the resurrection and so on as well, Jonathan. So there's lots to potentially pick up on here. Maybe start, though, with the view that Jonathan Pierce just doesn't believe people like Craig Keener's research is anything like up to the bar needed to start to get you down the road of, believing that there's some evidence for these kinds of miracle claims.
Sure, absolutely. So I'm not saying, and I don't believe, that all of the claims that Keener covers in his work on this subject are authentic miracles. But I think that there are enough of them which are plausible and enjoy multiple independent attestations, some with medical documentation, that it suggests to me cumulatively that the case for miracles is quite strong. So here's an example from Robert Larmer, who's a professor and chair of the Department of Philosophy at the University of New Brunswick. So he interviews Irene McDonald, who had been experiencing rapid deterioration from clearly diagnosed multiple sclerosis, and the specialist warned her that she was going to die soon. Her condition was terminal, and so she needed spinal injections for pain every 10 days. And one Friday afternoon, a friend told Irene that she was going to be healed. And of course, Irene was skeptical, but nonetheless, a dream and increased strength encouraged her. And so she asked on Sunday to be carried to church. And as she was being prayed for there, then a feeling spontaneously returned to her legs and her arms. And she had control of her body, and she regained muscular strength. And so she was walked from the church and was able to return to her pre-illness activities. And that was more than 25 years ago, but her symptoms have not relapsed. And there are other examples of that as well. I talked in my article on the subject, which listeners can find on my website, jonathanmcclatchy.com/writing. I also discussed the case of Barbara Snyder, who was diagnosed with progressive multiple sclerosis. This is discussed by Lee Strobel in his book, The Case for Miracles, although it's with an interview that he conducted with Craig Keener. And Craig Keener says that he confirmed the facts with two physicians who treated her. He says, there are numerous independent witnesses to her condition and years of medical records. In fact, two of her doctors were so astounded by her case that they've written about it in books, end quote. So her, Barbara's condition continues to worsen, and her diagnosis was confirmed through various diagnostic tests. They conducted spinal taps. And in the 16 years that followed, Keener says her condition continued to deteriorate. She spent months in hospitals, often for pneumonia, after being unable to breathe. One half of her diaphragm was paralyzed, which made her lung non-functional. The other half was operating at less than 50%. There was a tracheostomy tube was inserted into her neck. Oxygen was pumped from canisters in her garage. She lost control of her urination and bowels. There was a catheter that was inserted into her bladder. And she was declared legally blind, unable to read, and only capable of seeing objects as grey shadows. And a feeding tube was inserted into her stomach.
Optic neuritis, as part of that, optic neuritis is a hallmark of relapsing, remitting multiple sclerosis. So I've got progressive. You don't generally get optic neuritis, which is where you can go blind and then you regain your sight. So I know literally probably 100 people that have lost their sight and regained it. Like, it's just part of MS, right? Which is why I have to apply for, you know, specific driving licenses and whatnot, right? Okay, everything you're describing is also explicable naturalistically, okay? But what's happening is, I've got loads of problems with this, which is partly that all the sources for these two cases seem to be Christian sources. I've struggled to find any sources, medical sources that recount all of these, but also these are explicable naturalistically. What I'd like to know is when has God healed an amputee? And also, I think these sporadic, what I call sporadic miracles, are evidence against God, because it shows that God is cherry picking certain people. He's saying, do you know what? You're a quadriplegic. You've been faith healed by your church. So I'm going to make you walk, right? So he sends this miracle and this guy can walk. Bill Kent can walk, right? But at the same time, you know, all you other quadriplegics around the world, I'm not going to do anything for you. Do you know all you people with COVID? You can die. Do you know all the people with malaria? You can die. You know that tsunami of 240,000 people? I'm going to make this person with MS over there, you know, get better, but that can be explained naturalistically. But I let them get better, but I allow 240,000 people to die in a tsunami. So you'd be thinking, what is going on here that you can cherry pick these instances and also ignore all the other times when people have got better from MS, but without being prayed for and without a miracle? Ignore all them, ignore all the other unanswered prayers of people that didn't get better when they're prayed for, and cherry pick these ones and connect. It's a correlation fallacy and connect causality to that and say, look, God's made this sign, but that sign is more important than 240,000 people dying in a tsunami. I just find that really, really, and the evidence just isn't good enough. Like, sure, give me all the medical evidence for Barbara Snyder and for Irene McDonald's. I want all the medical evidence before I can assess that claim properly.
I mean, it sounds though, Jonathan P, that you're willing to, in principle, believe that these people did get better. You just say it's explicable by normal, you know, by
if you know MS, it's massively variable, right. And it's literally called relapsing remitting MS.
Okay, what then, Jonathan M, makes you feel that actually there is a miraculous explanation for these particular things? They weren't just things that happened in the natural course of time.
So Barbara Snyder was in hospice care at home. She had been told that she was going to die soon. So Strobel explains in the book that by 1981 she'd been able to walk. Hadn't been able to walk for 7 years. She was confined to bed. Her body twisted like a pretzel into a fetal position. Her hands were permanently flexed to the point that her fingers nearly touched her wrists. Her feet was locked in a downward position. Marshall explained to her fairly that it was just a matter of time before she would die. They agreed not to do any heroics, including including CPR or further hospitalization to keep her alive. This would only prolong the inevitable. Barbara entered hospice care in her home with a life expectancy of less than 6 months, end quote. So a caller informed a radio station of the Moody Bible Institute about Barbara's story, and a request was made for listeners to pray for her. And Barbara's church received some 450 letters from Christians indicating that they were praying for Barbara. And in 1981, on Pentecost Sunday, Barbara's aunt was reading to Barbara some of the letters that they had received offering prayers for her healing, joined by two other friends. And Barbara reportedly heard a male voice speak from behind her, "My child, get up and walk." And according to Marshall, who was one of the doctors, Barbara felt compelled to do immediately and what she was divinely instructed. So she literally jumped out of bed and removed her oxygen. She was standing on legs that had not supported her for years. Her vision was back, and she was no longer short of breath. Even without her oxygen, her contractions were gone, and she could move her feet and hands freely. And so that same evening, there was a worship gathering at her church where her illness was widely known about. And when the pastor asked if there were any announcements, she walks forward to the astonishment of the congregation. And the following day, there was the doctors conducted a chest X-ray, which confirmed that her lungs were perfectly normal, and the collapsed lung was completely expanded, and the intestine that had been vented to the abdominal wall was reconnected normally, and so she was restored to full health. And so that,
do you know the frequency of all the times in history that people have got better from a condition without being prayed for? Because what you really need to do is show that this one time when there was prayer and they got better, right, is categorically different from all the times through history that people have had illnesses and got better. Like, no matter how bad that illness is, that they've got better but without being prayed for. Because what you're doing is you're counting the hits and ignoring the misses. So to me, this is, until you can show that data, I don't think you're justified in believing it's a miracle, because you're committing the correlation fallacy. Or the God of the gaps. I don't understand how she got better, but I'm assuming it must be God.
Yeah, so two things. So first of all, in regards to the cherry-picking allegation, that I only focus on those cases where there is documentable answer to prayer and ignore the misses. I would say that there's an epistemic asymmetry such that the cases of documentable miracles is strong evidence that tends to confirm special divine action, whereas non-miraculous occurrences is only weak evidence against special divine action when someone isn't spontaneously healed, because there are explanations that can account for that within the context and framework of a Judeo-Christian worldview. And we know from the Bible that God doesn't always answer prayers, and God works in different people's experience in different ways, and there are reasons that God has for that.
But what about when miracles take place? I mean, the double standards accusation. So when you have miracles, and this is a really, really important point. So when you look at miracles that happened in Islam or in other cultures that are non-Judeo-Christian, so modern miracles, or indeed Islamic miracles from the Quran, like the six miracles of Muhammad. But when you look at modern miracles, your threshold for believing them for evidence is much, much higher, because that's without your worldview. So you're like, you're happy to believe Judeo-Christian miracles where people have prayed to your God and your followers have got better. But what about when this happens in another religion?
Yeah, so I've tried to look into miracle testimonies in other religions. I haven't found any literature which does the same work that Keener has done in regards to Christian miracles. If you have one, I'd really like to read it, but to this point, I'm not aware of any.
But is that to deny that miracles happen in any other religion? And even gurus like Satya Sai Baba, who's got better attested miracles than Jesus, but none of us believe them.
Okay, so even supposing that there are miracles in other religions, that still would point to a supernatural realm. So you could say that there are demonic spirits involved, for example. And in any case, if there's a spiritual realm, then that undermines your case against the prior probability in the case of Jesus' resurrection. In the case of Sai Baba, I think there's a difference between, say, materializing a watch, which was the sort of miracles that Sai Baba would perform, versus a claim like the resurrection of Jesus, where...
No.
Yeah.
Well, no, because I've had this exact argument before when someone said, oh, these are just little ones. And yes, okay, maybe to Jesus, because Jesus is God incarnate in human form. But as far as a miracle is concerned, if you're going to materialize a watch, you are breaking the laws of nature as we know it. Like, that is literally, if that genuinely happened tomorrow in India, Satya Sai Baba generally did that, he has broken what we know about physics, right? So that is a massive deal. Like, I know it sounds, oh, he's just materializing watch. That would literally break our fundamental understanding of the universe. It is pretty big.
The point of comparison I was trying to make with the resurrection is not the importance of the event. The point of comparison was rather that it's a lot more difficult to be honestly mistaken about observing your friend come back from the dead, especially given the polymodal or multi-sensory character of the resurrection encounters, where Jesus appears to not just individuals but groups of people on multiple occasions in different contexts, with appointment, without prior appointment, and it involves multiple sensory modes, including group conversations, physical contact, it's extended across a 40-day time period. He has long discourses with his followers, such as the Emmaus disciples and the 12. He is across a 40-day time period, so it's not one brief and confusing episode. That's very difficult to be honestly mistaken about, much more so than, say, materializing a watch, which can be done by a sleight of hand.
Okay, so let's concentrate on them. So in the case of the resurrection, right, and you have Jesus appearing to 500, the total evidence that we have for that claim of the dead dying and rising God, man, spirit, appearing to 500 people is like two lines in a letter that a religious leader sends to some new converts in order to convince them to believe what he believes, right? And it's like, It is, oh yeah, Jesus appeared to 500, some of them are dead, some of them are still alive. But you're in Corinth, and you can't even verify this. There's no way that you're going to be able to verify this claim. You have no desire to verify it, and I'm not providing any evidence other than a mere assertion that Jesus appeared to 500, which is better explained by a mistranslation of the appearance, and in fact it's Pentecost and there's a really good analysis. So there's an alternative hypothesis which is far more likely, but you are not justified. I would claim that even as a Christian with your background knowledge, you are still not justified in believing Paul's claim that Jesus appeared to 500.
But before we get a response to that, Jonathan McClatchy, and I'd like to hear responses to the other issues that Jonathan Pierce has raised as well around the background sort of information that you think makes the resurrection more likely in terms of fulfilled prophecy and other aspects. So we'll get into some of those specifics in just a moment's time. And in the final part of today's show, I also want to ask what sort of evidence would convince Jonathan Pierce in a resurrection. And we'll come to that, I'm sure, in a moment. So you're listening to a special show, Unbelievable, asking, do extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence? We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello, welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable. Continuing the conversation in a moment with our two Jonathans on extraordinary claims and extraordinary evidence. We'll hear some of your feedback as well. Not too much, though, because we're going a bit long on today's show. Coming up later on tonight on The Profile, theologian and church leader Greg Boyd will be the guest of Roger Harper. Now, Greg Boyd's been on Unbelievable several times over the years and is well known for his defence of open theism, his accommodationist view of God and Scripture, and his advocacy for non-violence. Well, look out for this interesting conversation with Greg. That's at 8 p.m. tonight on The Profile, also available via podcast wherever you get your podcast from. You're looking for The Profile. Greg's also featured in this month's edition of Premier Christianity magazine as well. Next week here on Unbelievable, should gay conversion therapy be banned? The UK government has published proposals to ban gay conversion therapy, and there's a consultation open at the moment until the 4th of February. Now, should such a law be welcomed by churches as a protection for LGBT people, or a cause for concern at the potential criminalisation of prayer? Two different perspectives will join me. Peter Linus of the UK Evangelical Alliance and Jane Ozan of the Ban Conversion Therapy Coalition. They'll be debating this proposed legislation on the show next week. Don't forget, you can get in touch with us as well, and we'll hear some of your feedback, as I said, towards the end of today's show. Don't forget to rate and review us if you're listening via iTunes or wherever you get your podcast from. That also helps as well. Right now, time to get into the final part of today's show. Proper old atheist Christian debate on the show today. Do extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, we've been asking. And we've been particularly looking at modern miracle claims. We've been looking at the central claim of Christianity, the resurrection, something probably we'll do again around Easter this year. But Jonathan Pierce is an atheist blogger and writer. His books like The Resurrection, A Critical Examination of the Easter Story, are his way of showing why he believes that these kind of miracle claims do not stand up to scrutiny. Jonathan McClatchy is a Christian apologist with a background in biology who's done a lot of work in this area as well. His new resource is called talkaboutdoubts.com. So go and check that out if you're someone or you know someone who would like to directly engage with a Christian thinker about the evidence for Christianity, doubts and so on. I'll make sure there are links to both my guests, but you can find Jonathan Pierce through a new network that's coming soon, very soon, I believe, called... what's it called again?
Only Sky.
Jonathan McClatchy is at jonathanmcclatchy.com as well. Okay, Jonathan McClatchy in this case. Just come back on some of this, because obviously every time you give reasons, you know, from the Bible, either the New Testament or the Old Testament, some of this background information about why you think there is good reason to take these sorts of miracle accounts seriously, especially the resurrection. Every time Jonathan Pierce says, well, look, I just don't think you've got the evidence you think you've got there or the background information, because, you know, these prophetic accounts were all made up after the fact. There's no historical evidence, archaeological evidence for the existence of many characters in the Old Testament. And the New Testament, you know, you're dealing with just one, in that instance of, you know, the claim of 500 witnesses to the resurrection, just one line from a letter from Paul to the Corinthians, which could arguably be interpreted in a different way. All of this stuff. So, you know, there's a lot there. Where would you go with the fact that just every moment, if you like, Jonathan Pierce just weighs that background evidence very differently to you?
Right. And I'll say this is only able to scratch the surface, because as these conversations progress, the number of things you need to talk about increases, it doesn't decrease.
Good point.
There's a lot that could be responded to here, and I'm sure Jonathan Pierce feels the same way. But in regards to the background information, I mentioned earlier the trilemma argument, which is a background consideration in regards to the messianic and divine identity of Jesus. I disagree with some of what Pierce said in response to that particular contention. I think that all four of the synoptic gospels affirm the deity of Christ. I could unpack that in a lot of detail, but it would take up some time, so I'll not distract from our current purpose. But I've written extensively on this. I've also done debates or just focused on that topic, so you can check that out. In regards to other types of background evidence, as Justin alluded to, I would argue from messianic prophecy, or the phenomenon of what I sometimes call messianic convergence, which is where you have events which correlate in the Gospels with Old Testament features and background in ways that are surprising on the chance of coincidence. And there's a number of examples for that. I'll just give two or three. One that is fairly indisputable, in fact, is that Christianity became established as a worldwide global religion. And that's something which is predicted in Isaiah 49, Isaiah 42, and elsewhere in the Old Testament, that forecast that the Messiah will bring a recognition of the God of Israel to representatives of all nations, that the Messiah will be a light to the Gentiles, that God's salvation will reach to the ends of the earth. Now, Jesus uniquely has brought representatives of all nations to a recognition of the God of Israel. And so that, in my opinion, is not sufficient grounds to think that Christianity is true, but it does provide evidence by virtue of the fact that it's more probable or better predicted on the hypothesis that Jesus is the Messiah than on its falsehood. Another example would be that Jesus' death coincides with the Feast of Passover. So Jesus dies on Nisan 15th, according to all four Gospels. I know Pierce disputes that in his book, but I would argue that he's in error. And the background to the Feast of Passover, if you look at the Old Testament, is that the Jews were to select a lamb, which they were to slaughter, and then they would smear the blood of that lamb on the doorposts of their homes just as they were leaving Egypt. This is the last of the 10 plagues of Egypt in the Exodus account. And Then when the angel of death passed over the homes and saw the blood, instead of smiting down the firstborn of that household, he would see the blood and pass over. And so that's where the idea of Passover comes from. And so Jesus in the New Testament is presented and portrayed as the fulfillment of that Passover lamb, that he is the ultimate Passover lamb that the Passover feast pointed to. And so it's quite a coincidence, it's quite fitting then, that Jesus' death coincides with the Feast of Passover. That's a strange coincidence.
That's completely what you'd expect, given an alternate hypothesis, which is the gospel writers want him to be the sacrificial lamb. So it's the whole thing is a rewriting of Yom Kippur, where actually Jesus is the sacrificial goat, and Jesus Barabbas, Jesus son of the Father, that's what Bar Abbas means, is the scapegoat. So Jewish ritual, you'd have Yom Kippur, which is the ritual of atonement, and you'd take two goats that were as identical as they could be, and one goat you'd let free and into the wilderness. That's your scapegoat. That's Jesus Barabbas, Jesus son of the Father. They had to be like twins, and Jesus son of the Father is executed. So this other goat is executed. Turns out that the ones executed often has a scarlet ribbon like tied around it, and even thorns. So then you start, well, why is Matthew attaching a scarlet robe to Jesus? Because he wants. So what they're doing is they're writing theology. They're not writing history. What you're doing is you're presupposing this is just historical, and he's saying look how well this accords with the theology here, so it must be true. It's written so that it accords with theology. Like what you want to look at are things historically verifiable claims.
I want to ask Jonathan McClatchy, you know, whether he agrees with you on that, because another point of view, I suppose, Jonathan McClatchy, is that Jonathan Pierce is presupposing that it was all created, you know, invented after the fact to fulfill messianic prophecy. Your view obviously is that no, in fact, there are various events that could not have been orchestrated or things and so on that were being honestly historically reported. So why do you think that's the more likely sort of piece of evidence we're looking at than Jonathan Pierce's view that this was all effectively theology written after the fact?
So for sure, I think that we need to look at the Gospels as a whole to determine, are they holistically reliable? And I think that the evidence overwhelmingly suggests that the Gospels and Acts are written by individuals who are close up to the facts, they're well-informed and habitually truthful. And we can look at particular details regarding Jesus' crucifixion, and it's the crucifixion is just anchored in it being Nisan 15th. So for example, if we...
But you're using the Gospels to prove the Gospels. You're presupposing the truth.
Well,
of
I think that's legitimate. I'm not presupposing the truth, okay. But I am using the Gospels as evidence for the reliability of the Gospels. Sure.
So written 40 to 80 years by non-eyewitness. We don't know who the authors were. We don't know where they wrote it. We don't know when they wrote it, although we can guess. They're ex post facto agendas, which means they already believe there's a Messiah. Then they're writing about the accounts of their lives. They are writing in order to propagandize, to persuade the audience of certain things. They use no historiographical techniques at all that are recognizable, other than Luke occasionally mentions some people that existed and some places that existed, and you can't verify the claims, and they weren't verified. So this is just such low level evidence.
Yeah,
sorry.
Go ahead, Jonathan McClatchy.
Sure. So this is a very lengthy discussion, and as I said before, the number of things that we want to discuss increases over time, doesn't decrease. I think that the Gospels and Acts are demonstrably reliable. I think you can confirm the gospel reliability by looking at hallmarks of verisimilitude, such as undesigned coincidences, which I've written a lot about. I'm sure Jonathan is familiar with that argument. Extra-biblical corroborations of the gospel accounts. Jonathan Pierce mentioned the literary techniques that he says that the Gospels don't employ, and this is also an argument he makes in his book, and I think that this is very a weak argument. I can give an example. So one of the arguments, for instance, and he gets this from Richard Carrier, is that Luke doesn't cite his sources, and this was a very common ancient technique, was to cite your sources.
None of them cite their sources.
Exactly. So if we look at some of these other ancient sources, such as Thucydides, for example, in his Peloponnesian War, here's a quote from Thucydides, who says, with reference to the speeches in this history, some were delivered before the war began, others while it was going on, some I heard myself, others I got from various quarters. But as to the actions of the war, I have not been content to report them on the authority of any chance informant or from my own conception of them, but either from personal knowledge where I was present or after the most careful investigation possible, in every case, where I gained my information from others. Very laborious were these inquiries, since those who were present in the several actions did not all give the same account of the same affair, but as they were swayed by favor to one side or the other, as their memory served them. Possibly this avoidance of any fabulous embellishments may make my work less entertaining, but I shall be well content if those shall pronounce my history useful, who desire to gain a view of events as they really did happen, and as they are very likely, in accordance with human nature, to repeat themselves at some future time, and is designed rather as a possession forever than as a mere prize of composition to be listened to for the moment. So there's an example, and I can give other examples, of an ancient author giving a very similar introduction to Luke. He does, it's not, we find both Thucydides as well as Dionysus of Halicarnassus doing very much what Luke does. They give their own credentials on the topic by talking about the kind of sources that they sought, but not naming them. And so the resemblance to
Luke doesn't do that. I'm going to call you out on that, because Luke categorically does not do what Thucydides does there. Thucydides gives a heck of a lot more detail about his historiographical techniques there and who his sources are and how he uses the sources. Luke says this has been passed down, blah, 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 but this says nothing nearly so long as what you've just said or of the same quality of you just said. And Thucydides also admits that he makes up speeches. He says that, you know, I think it's what was broadly what they, it's in the spirit of what they said, whereas none of the Gospels, which are jam-packed full of speech, you tell me any history book in ancient time that has speech that we think is accurate, who was there writing it down? What, you know, I don't know. No, I would just have to disagree with that. I'm sorry.
So I think that has a striking resemblance to the prologue that we find in Luke. Luke says, "Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things that you have been taught." So just like Thucydides, he doesn't name his sources, but he does indicate the type of sources that he's used in constructing his account.
It's about a tenth of the length and didn't have nearly as many of the claims. I mean, it's interesting because what happens, so with Thucydides, though, is we look at extra Thucydides accounts, accounts outside of Thucydides to see what corroborates his claims, right? With let's take Matthew 28. So you've got zombie saints parading around Jerusalem, so which is interesting because Jesus isn't the first fruits of the resurrection. You've already got resurrected saints that apparently Matthew says were seen by many in Jerusalem. You've got an earthquake, you've got 3 hours of darkness, and you've got the rending of the temple veil in the Holy of Holies, right? All of those are magnificently incredible claims. And none of them are attested to outside of Matthew barely. Well, at least the zombies and the earthquake are Matthew only. Otherwise, it's just a couple of the Gospels attest these things. And you're telling me that Josephus wouldn't report the fact that dead zombies paraded around Jerusalem and many saw these dead zombies, and that the Holy of the Holies, the temple veil, is this most sacrosanct relic in or artifact in Jewish, like, in the Jewish religion, and to think that was ripped in two and not reported by any Jew outside of the Gospels, which are all four codependent like texts, are really based on Mark with embellishments. That's what I have problems with, which is this is not the level of evidence
there's another whole bag of things to potentially respond to there, Jonathan. I'm aware of time is getting away from us. And I am also interested in hearing your response to this 500 witnesses objection as well from Jonathan Pierce. But okay, what about some of these claims around the passion story, the rising of the saints, the ripping of the temple curtain? Where do you go with the fact that for Jonathan Pierce, given that it's only mentioned in this one source, it's not a reliable piece of evidence?
Right, sure. And this is, of course, a species of the argument from silence, which I think is a very, very weak historical argument. My colleague and friend, Dr. Timothy McGrew, actually has an academic paper where he reviews the argument from silence and exposes why it's so weak. And the reason it's weak is because when you calibrate your expectations by looking at other ancient sources from that time period, you find that there are plenty of examples of events that you would expect to be recorded, which aren't in particular sources. So, and furthermore, most of the literature from Palestine in the first century has been lost. So even if someone else wrote about the event, it's not particularly predicted that we would still have the work. I can give here's just a couple examples of things that we have very good reason to think happened, but ancient sources pass over them in detail, even though you would expect them to talk about them. Josephus and Philo both pass over.
Do they break the laws of nature?
Well, let me finish. So Josephus and Philo both pass over the expulsion of the Jews from Rome by Claudius in silence, though it's mentioned by the second century Roman historian Suetonius, and is also mentioned in passing in Acts 18 verse 2. And despite Josephus's silence on that, all historians acknowledge that that event took place. Another example is that no first century source that we now have reports the destruction of Pompeii and Herculaneum in the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in AD 79, although Pliny the Younger gives a detailed account of the eruption himself. In fact, his uncle, Pliny the Elder, was killed in that eruption. But no one infers from Pliny's silence that the event didn't take place. The only first century source that we have of the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem is Josephus. But we don't infer from the fact that no one...
We've literally got Herculaneum. We've literally got the remains of Herculaneum and Pompeii. Like, you can't... I mean, wow.
But I'm using these examples to illustrate that even for events that we know took place, such as the destruction of Herculaneum and Pompeii, we have ancient sources that that pass over it, even though Pliny the Younger talks about the eruption, he passes over the destruction of these major cities of Pompeii and Herculaneum. And there are plenty of examples of that where you have these major events. The expulsion of the Jews from Rome was a major event that no first century source talks about. And apart from Acts.
Let me come to another point that Jonathan Pierce raised earlier, which is this part of 2 Corinthians 15, I think it is, where as Paul is recounting, you know, the events of the Jesus and the Last Supper and the resurrection. And he says that 500 witnesses, some of whom have died, but some of whom are still alive. And again, the fact that you referenced that as a piece of evidence was why Jonathan was responding to that, saying that's not a good piece of evidence. It's one assertion in one letter that no one would have been able to check, and so on. What's your response to that kind of?
Sure, it was actually Jonathan Pierce that brought that up. I didn't actually mention that.
Sorry,
but I don't consider it to be a major line of evidence. The appearance of the 500 that Paul writes about in 1 Corinthians 15. And I think it's subject to some of the vulnerabilities that Jonathan Pierce talked about, that he doesn't name them, and it's not clear that they would have had access or been able to go and check with these 500 witnesses. So it's not a major part of my apologetic approach to the resurrection. But I would argue, I disagree with the approach, and we've discussed this before in your program, Justin, with the approach taken by Gary Habermas, the minimal facts approach, which basically... a major part of that approach is limiting one's case for the resurrection to the Pauline corpus, especially texts like 1 Corinthians 15, 3 through 7, and so forth. I think that you cannot make a robust case for the resurrection without bringing in the Gospels. And I think that you can make a robust case for Gospel reliability from undesigned coincidences, extra-biblical corroborations, and other hallmarks of verisimilitude, the unity of character portrayals across the Gospels in different settings and contexts and so forth, all of which point to the reliability of the Gospel accounts. And therefore, if the Gospels are indeed substantially trustworthy accounts written by individuals who are close up to the facts and well-informed, then it suggests strongly that the reports that we have in the Gospels concerning the nature and variety of the post-resurrection encounters with the risen Jesus are coming from or reflecting the eyewitness testimony. And therefore, that's what we need to explain when we're trying to explain why they're making those claims. Is it that they are deceiving us, or is it they're honestly mistaken, or Jesus rising from the dead?
We're almost out of time, and I'm aware we spent a lot of the show really debating the specifics of the evidences here and the back and forth, and less probably on the general case of the sort of thought about extraordinary claims, extraordinary evidence, and so on. Just briefly, Jonathan Pierce, if you were to be convinced that Jesus had risen from the dead, is there any kind of evidence, you know, that could convince you at this point, or is it sort of something that's in the past now and therefore intrinsically impossible for you to sort of be convinced about?
So there's a really good question. And the simple answer is I don't know, because of something called doxastic involuntarism. So this is in philosophy. There's a bit of jargon there. It's the fact that when we assent to a proposition, when we believe something, we don't do it voluntarily. So if I asked either of you, if I say the moon is made of cheese, can you believe that the moon is made of cheese? You wouldn't be able to change your belief voluntarily. So you don't have doxastic voluntarism. In order to just change your belief and then put your mortgage on the fact that yes, the moon is made of cheese. So what happens is we believe things rather intuitively once a certain threshold is met in our non-conscious brains, given an amount of evidence that we can't really actually
express verbally, because we're not really sure. Like, so I could give you some amount of evidence and might in principle be enough, but I just don't know whether when it came to it, that would be enough. What I'm fairly confident in saying is that the Gospels and Paul are not good enough evidence. I don't think they're even good enough evidence, even if you do believe in miracles. So I wanted to talk about biblical hermeneutic circularity earlier, which is the fact that the reason that, I think JM believes in miracles is because he believes in the resurrection. I think he believes in resurrection because he believes in miracles. And I think there's a circularity that's going on there, but we probably don't have time. But that's super important because it's all about what we're bringing to the table. And that's why we're talking about how we did get onto the Gospels and how reliable they are, because that's where this goes. Where this goes is, why is it that I think the Gospels are this good and he thinks they're that good? And this, so I'm happy we got here, and JM's absolutely right. There's like 50 million more questions to answer.
Yes, there are indeed. I mean, and as for you, Jonathan McClatchy, do you think that this particular phrase, this maxim, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, has been used to simply, I don't know, bat away, skeptics have used it to bat away really having to deal with the evidence full stop, because they set the bar, in a sense, can set the bar so high that they don't have to deal with any kind of claim.
Right, absolutely. Any proposition with a non-zero prior probability, that is to say that it doesn't entail some sort of logical incoherence, can in principle be demonstrated if you have sufficient evidence. And any miracle claim, no matter how improbable, can in principle be demonstrated with sufficient testimonial evidence, because testimony is a form of evidence, and if you have enough of it, then the improbability of the testimony will eventually become greater than the improbability of the miracle. But I think the key bone of contention between myself and Jonathan is how we assess the prior probability. And of course, there's a lot of background assumptions, and this is one of the weaknesses, I think, of doing debates like this in such a short time frame, is that there's very little common ground between myself and Jonathan, and so we have to start way back at an earlier point. I obviously do think that you can make a robust case that the Gospels are substantially reliable and close up to the facts. Jonathan doesn't think that, but to discuss that would require a whole debate in itself, and the same with a lot of the things that we've only been able to scratch the surface on today. He mentioned there's a circular argument at play, and I don't think that is the case. I think that first of all, as I said, the probability of a miracle is non-zero unless you can show some sort of logical incoherence, and so it can be demonstrated with evidence even if the probability is very low. And secondly, I think that there is evidence that informs our background considerations, such as the miracle testimonies documented by Keener and others, the evidence bearing on Jesus' messianic and divine identity that's independent of the resurrection bears on our background considerations, the fact that the resurrection is something that's prophesied in Isaiah 53:10, and Jesus, of course, claims that the resurrection will be his own the vindication of his messianic and divine self claims. All of that feeds into our background considerations. So I don't think there's any circularity going on there.
We're going to have to leave it there. I appreciate there's lots that Jonathan Pierce would want to respond to, even in that closing statement of yours, Jonathan McClatchy. But we will leave it there, and appreciate that. Hey, maybe we can, you know, delve into one specific aspect of this again at some point in the future. And appreciate
you. Isaiah 53. The rest of it doesn't apply to Jesus at all.
Oh, but well. See, we're already doing the comebacks. Maybe we'll do a proper debate on these sort of prophecies that are often used in defense of Jesus's messiahship and resurrection. But for the now, we will say goodbye. Thank you both, Jonathan M. and Jonathan P., for being with me on the show today. You can find links to the books we've referenced, the articles, to talkaboutdoubts.com, and more besides with today's show. But for now, thanks both Jonathans for a great discussion. It would be great to know what you made of today's debate. You can email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can find the show on Facebook at facebook.com/premierunbelievable. And you can find me on Twitter @unbelievablejb, also on TikTok and Instagram as justin.briley. Leave us your feedback, whatever way works for you, and I try and compile it all and bring some of it each week. Not too much time for your feedback today, because we've gone a bit long with today's conversation, but lovely to hear these encouraging messages from Chris Thompson, first of all, on Twitter saying, recent podcast from Unbelievable with conversations between Professor N.T. Wright and Tom Holland and also with Douglas Murray have been top draw. N.T. Wright on fire on Jesus's place in it all and a fascinating and honouring conversation and disagreement on display. Really worth a listen. Thank you very much. Josh Klein also mentioned us to say it would be remiss to not thank Justin for hosting such an interesting discussion on his programme. If you ever want to dive into content that's interesting, God-honouring, thought-provoking, challenging, well-produced, I couldn't recommend his content more. Thank you very much indeed. Now, Jay Gardner's been in touch, and on last week's show, I read out a couple of emails from people who said I shouldn't have referred to the January 6th events at Capitol Hill of 2021 as an insurrection. Jay Gardner begs to differ, says long-time listener, second-time emailer, always loved the show. And I take issue with two emails you read at the end of that episode, though. The January 6th event in Washington, D.C. was definitely an insurrection. The protesters may not have wielded guns or explosives, but they violently stormed the U.S. Capitol to stop the certification of a legitimate presidential election. Many Trump supporters were fed lies about election integrity from Trump and his allies. Some specifically chanted death threats against the Vice President Pence and other prominent leaders. Many were hurt, several were killed, and over 100 violent protesters are being prosecuted with several convictions. Congressional hearings are underway. Thank you very much. Again, obviously, opinion is divided on exactly what that event counted as. Vicky gets in touch to say, I enjoy your great interviews and podcasts. Have you ever discussed Harry Potter on any of your shows, such as How Should Christians Respond? My children have to read it in English at school. They've now read most of the books and watched the films, but I felt uncomfortable about it, but have decided to go with it. Another friend is now facing this and has written to the Christian school where their children go to ask why they study such a book. Would love your thoughts and any of your panel of experts' thoughts on this. Thank you, Vicky, for getting in touch. I don't think we've done Harry Potter, though I'm sure it's come up in conversation a few times on the show, but I am aware that there is a Harry Potter and the Gospel book that's been published recently. In fact, I think Premier Christianity carried an opinion piece on that. If you're asking my personal opinion, my kids read Harry Potter. In fact, my daughter Grace is a huge Harry Potter fan. They've watched the films. And my view is that I understand why some Christians may have concerns, but for me, it's a classic fantasy tale of good versus evil. I don't think that the kind of witchcraft and wizardry on display is any worse than what you would find in the Narnia stories by C.S. Lewis. And for me, it's all about the intention of the author ultimately. And I think J.K. Rowling does have a good intention. You know, she is, as far as I'm aware, a Christian. And there are lots of actual Christian references, especially in the later books, in my experience of Harry Potter. So I think the Christian worldview actually does inform the books quite significantly, despite the sort of fantastical sort of genre of writing of witches and wizards and so on. And I just don't have a problem personally with that. I think it's our kids can distinguish, fact from fantasy, and that's fine. You know, I think those genres are helpful in helping us to imagine, the bigger themes of love and justice and everything else that comes out of those books. So that would be my personal advice. Of course, others may take a different view. Great to also hear from Eric Strandness, who regularly blogs for us for Unbelievable. And you can find links to the blog from today's show if you want to read some of his recent writing. We had Terry Sanderson in a debate with David Bentley Hart on a classic replay edition of Unbelievable over the Christmas period. And Eric says, it seems to me that the debates we hear over whether a secular or Christian worldview provides the best framework for a society hinges upon which one can be proven to avoid the most casualties. One side points to Christian atrocities, while the other to secular atrocities, as if a body count is the determining factor for which system works best. The reality is that we all have blood on our hands. All the atrocities, both Christian and secular, have one thing in common. They're perpetrated by humans. So I think the real question is not which system does the most good, but which one explains why we do so much bad. Why do good intentions so often get derailed by bad practice? Why does power corrupt and absolute power corrupt absolutely? We need to ask ourselves, Which system is better prepared to deal with endemic human wickedness? A secular system that says we can do it on our own, or a Christian system that's honest enough to admit we are powerless without Jesus? Secularists are hopelessly optimistic about a less than stellar human track record, while Christians have read the historical headlines and concluded that every human project must begin with a broken and contrite heart. Christianity seems the most reliable worldview because it recognizes the fallen nature of humans and puts societal safeguards into place. Secularism, on the other hand, assumes people will do the right thing, but then all too often ends up putting its trust in a dictator. You enjoyed that show, you said, Eric. And yes, if you haven't heard it, it's worth checking out one of our recent classic replays, Terry Sanderson versus David Bentley Hart on Atheist Delusions. I enjoyed re-listening to that one myself. That's all we've time for now. Thanks for those who are still sending in responses to topics I'd like to see in 2022. We're putting them all in the big hat, and we've got some exciting stuff coming up for you in this year. But for now, thanks for being with us. God bless you. We'll see you next time. There's another barnstormer of a debate next week. Should gay conversion therapy be banned? The UK government has published proposals to ban conversion therapy, and a consultation period is currently open for people to give their views. Well, should such a law be welcomed by churches as a protection for LGBT people, or could it have a chilling effect on simply offering prayer to people who want to be counselled because of same-sex attraction? Peter Linus from the UK Evangelical Alliance will be critiquing some of the proposals on the table. Jane Ozan of the Banned Conversion Therapy Coalition will be championing them. That's our debate next week. Hope you can join us. See you then.